Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 5th, 2000. In the Creekside Room this evening, Phil Anderson continues his study on borders and beliefs, U.S. policy and practice vis-a-vis a faith-based vision for response to the uprooted migrants and refugees. Tonight's topic is the U.S. southern border, the changing socioeconomic political ecosystem. This is session ANP 2000-2. Let's listen in.
I'm going to get started here in, what room is this called?
Creekside.
Not the fireside room, the Creekside room. Okay. Well, we are going to talk about borders, and particularly this U.S.-Mexico border, as well as, to some degree, some work around the Caribbean. Not nearly as much. We'll also want to keep in mind, in terms of borders, U.S.-Canadian border and comparisons. What's going on one border? What's attitudes toward the northern border as opposed to the southern border? I don't know. I haven't seen any on the northern border. Actually, there are more Border Patrol people, yes, being deployed also to the north, but 99% are going to the south.
And they're not Canadians who are coming over.
Actually, that's an interesting thing, because the Canadians, over time, at least in, say, 20, 30 years ago, used to be one of the primary populations of people who overextended their visa, let us say, and that were undocumented or overextended their documentation in the United States, Canadians.
Funny,
in the United States.
Yeah.
Funny. Okay, we're gonna do a little bit of both poetry and plumbing tonight. Poetry, because we're gonna do some envisioning, talking about visions and thinking, which I think is the fun part. Actually, this session is one that I've been looking forward to. I'm gonna try out some ideas. And we really are looking for beginning to think outside the box when it comes to issues of migration in this hemisphere. And I picked up that term poetry and plumbing from a colleague in Washington, D.C., Demetrius Papadimitrio, who works with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And about 2 weeks ago in Washington, he presented to a major forum of Canadians and U.S. and Mexican people a little paper on envisioning the future of North America, a kind of a North America integration project, as he calls it. Mexicans, many that I know, don't like the term integration, but it's a tentative term. How are we going to look at the Americas in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So that's available. It's kind of an academic piece, but it shows you some of the conversations that's going on at, I would say, very important high levels. The State Department is involved in those discussions. A lot of academics and a lot of people at the grassroots level, people in business as well. So we're gonna also do a little bit of poetry ourselves tonight. And then we're gonna actually do some plumbing, that is, what are the details in some ways about this, about the actual border situation, focusing on the U.S. southern border primarily. As we sit here this evening around the world, and as you know, historically, migration, I mean, that's been a part of human history since day one. I mean, I even think of the biblical imagery, Adam and Eve, out of the garden, you know, migrants, expelled, exiles, you know. It began, you know, from our mythology or however you understand that, it's just a part of it. As we sit here this evening, about 100 million people on this earth are migrating. They're looking for a new home. They're going from one country to another in search of something new. 100 million, 6 billion U.S., 6 billion people, approximately 100 million. That's about one out of every 60 people are actually uprooted, not because necessarily of their own choice, but they're moving on. They've said, you know, I can't sustain my livelihood here, or I prefer to look somewhere else for my livelihood. It's quite amazing. A biblical text, just to begin, from Isaiah. It's tremendous how the Bible and the often prophetic words, imageries come alive for us. As I was doing some work on tonight's presentation, this passage leapt out to me. And ironically, and it really fits in terms of what I see is going on, humanity looking for the creation of something new, something stable, something life-giving from what has been not life-giving. And this is very much the situation of people from Mexico, from Central America, from the Caribbean that are moving forward, moving north from those areas, that it's not life-giving for them in the broadest sense, and they are searching for something. In part of my life, I worked quite a bit in Central America. This text I used at another point of human migration, that is, from the 70s and 80s, there was about one out of every seven Guatemalans was displaced from their homes during the war in Guatemala. Many of them went into southern Mexico. Some came to the United States, Los Angeles, Florida, all over the U.S. But many stayed in refugee camps here. And they also had this desire to go back and to create something new. So even in the midst of the war, they asked to have the international protection to go home. So, of course, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is involved, and they asked for the church to be present with them as they organized their way back to their communities of origin in the middle of the war. I was asked to be a mediator for the return of the refugees. And on the first mass return of about 4,000 Guatemalans, the bishop, Samuel Ruiz in Chiapas, Mexico, he wanted to celebrate a farewell mass for these primarily indigenous people going back into a war zone in northern Guatemala. And so he asked me, as a Lutheran pastor, Felipe, would you please come and be a part of the mass? Sure, I'd love to do that. So as we all got little robes on and we were walking in procession, and he said, now, Felipe, you're going to bring the word. That means you're going to bring the homily. You're going to preach the sermon, you know. And I said, oh, my goodness, but you have to honor that request. And so I searched, and I asked him, you know, there's a passage in Isaiah, I think. And he says, Isaiah 65, that about going home. And let me read that. For I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating. For I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and delight in my people. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard in it or the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. And just think those words, what they mean, with children dying as they were fleeing Guatemala, or old people having to actually say, leave me here so that you all can go on. For one who dies at 100 years will be considered a youth, and one who falls short of 100 will be considered accused. Now think of this in terms of abandoning your home or being forced out of your home and your home's burned. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit, nor shall they plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall enjoy the works of their own hands. Think of all the laborers in our fields. For they shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord and their descendants as well. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, but the serpent, its food shall be dust. They shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain. So here are the lambs going back to the homes of the wolves in Guatemala. What we have now are people coming north into the United States from the Caribbean, Haiti, particularly Cuba, seeking something new. The people that I talk to, no jobs, particularly post-Hurricane Mitch. Now 2 years this fall, end of October, Hurricane Mitch devastates this region, particularly Honduras and Nicaragua, some to a less degree in El Salvador, very little Guatemala, some in Belize. No jobs for the people, and a lot of homes destroyed. I work with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, and I invite you to, somebody asked the other day, how do we stay in touch with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service? One way, if you have used the websites, lirs.org is how you get a hold of us. We're beginning a new border initiative to begin to get some handles on what is going on in terms of migration in this hemisphere. And we're getting a lot now of displaced people from Colombia because of the war. A lot from Ecuador as well, which has gone through quite a bit of turmoil. Most, of course, of those who come and impact this southern border contiguous with the United States are Mexicans. And the Immigration and Naturalization Service, in terms of its border controls, has basically two categories. In terms of how they count numbers, Mexicans, other than Mexicans, along that border. Last year, about 1.5 million Mexicans were deported from this southern border back to Mexico. Now, some of those may have been duplicates, like 2, 3, 10, 12 times. And to the extent that those numbers go up and they're captured, they might spend some time in jail. They may go before a judge and he will say, you are barred for 3 to 10 years, or if you keep doing it, forever. Barred from ever entering the United States.
They are pesky, aren't they, those Mexicans?
So this border initiative of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, we have three main goals. One is to learn. And there, we need help and opinions and thoughts and insights and experiences that are going on. Then we need to educate our own constituency, primarily that is within the Lutheran Church, but beyond that. And then we need to network. We need to really link up those people who are doing anything vis-a-vis the southern border, that is within the Lutheran Church, and stimulate some work that focuses on this and beef it up. And that would involve non-Lutherans as well, of course. Then secondly, we need to raise our voice or increase our speaking out on issues related to the southern border, or to border issues, or to migration issues. One of our contacts in El Paso is a gentleman named Ruben Garcia. He runs a home, and since the early 80s, kind of a sanctuary hospitality house, which sort of this little cat and mouse game. INS knows that that's what it's for undocumented people, but it's in one of those cocoons where, okay, you can come to El Paso, but the real control is like 25 miles up the road. You can't get out of there. But sure, so Ruben Garcia operates this Annunciation House as kind of a Catholic worker, very ecumenical program. He says that what the church needs to do is break the silence on what's going on in terms of the indignity being imposed upon people, migrants. And so it is part of our task to raise our voice to some extent. We don't know exactly right now. It's not predetermined what we would say. We know we have to say something. So we have to, and that would include some public policy advocacy on some issues. Third, and most importantly, perhaps, is that we have to begin to work with others to create something new. What we're very sure of, and kind of our operating thesis, is that what is happening right now is not cost effective. If our goal is to stop migration, we're not doing it. If our goal is to do that with all due respect to all people, we're not doing that. If our goal is to get at the root causes of migration, we're not doing that. And what we really have is an untenable situation in our policies. It's unethical in many ways, and it becomes immoral in many ways, as from the point of view of the church. And it takes a while to get there, but I think that's where I have gotten now after about 25 years of work that has involved some coming and going across this border. And I think we have to be very clear about that. And that's just, in a way, it's where I'm saying that the issues of borders and beliefs, which side are we on? You know, are we, for example, first and foremost, my country, right or wrong, or what do we do as Christian people who ought to be ecumenical in its broadest sense, that we transcend borders?
Yeah, like we have. Like you, the Chicanos have been doing.
Yes. Okay. So that. Now, tonight we've got till about quarter of, and I would really like to get into quite a lot of discussion. I'm going to try to keep my next comments to about 15 minutes so that at about 25 after, I'll break and we'll really try to get into some discussion. But I want to propose, well, let me just say a couple more things about this border real quick. This is the border that represents the largest income disparity in the world, United States, Mexico. No other place in the world has such a broad discrepancy of incomes. It's also a huge discrepancy in power relationship, which does not exist that dramatically in other parts of the world. Since 1923, since James Monroe talked about the Monroe Doctrine, or had a speech in which we now call the Monroe Doctrine, this has sort of been considered, you know, our backyard, and sort of we kind of call the shots. And that's been played out time and time again throughout Latin America. A very, very significant thing happened on Sunday. What took place Sunday in this region?
Elections. Yeah, in Mexico.
In Mexico. The more I think about that, it's quite incredible. again, trying to put some of this in some historical perspective. The United States acquired much of the West, California, I think of Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico,
Texas.
Parts of Wyoming, Colorado. That was the result of the 46 to 48 Mexican-American War, 1848. That's not very long ago, 150 years, roughly. And then we picked up a little slice over here under the Gadsden Purchase about 5 years later in 1853. So that's not very long ago, relatively. Since then, Mexico has gone through a number of revolutions. They had a dictator toward the end of last century, major revolution at the beginning of this century with Zapata and Pancho Villa. And then into this kind of post-Cold War era. It's interesting what took place during the Cold War. Mexico became part of what was called the Non-Aligned Nations and really played a significant role. Or they called it at one point the Group of 77 Non-Allied Nations. That is, vis-a-vis the U.S. and Russian foreign policy, it maintained some independence. That is that power relationship. They really wanted to say, you know, look, we're not in your backyard. What took place, PRI came to power in Mexico, I believe it was 1918. Or 1917. So about 50, 60, 70 years after, 70 years after the loss of all of this land, now out to the year 2000, Mexican Revolution. This was the Mexican Revolution of Zapata and Francisco Villa. So half of the life of Mexico in kind of its modern configuration has been under the PRI. Half. The Partido de Revolución Institucional, Institutional Revolutionary Party. And they were dominant for this last 72 years. They lost big on Sunday. Now, I just saw some of the preliminary La Bastida for PRI, La Bastida.
The idea.
Got about 31%. His main opponent, Vicente Fox, got something like 48%. Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas got about 16%. So this is two-thirds of the vote against a dominant power of PRI that's been there for 72 years.
We've never lost.
So that's significant.
So which one was the PRI candidate?
La
Bastida.
La Bastida.
And he lost, PRI.
And they had
this was called, he was from the PAN party, though he formed what was called the Alianza with some other parties. What was interesting about this is that a lot of Cardenas supporters, which is basically a left-wing party, and he was the son of a socialist president from Mexico at the time of FDR, a lot of them opted to go with Vicente Fox, some of the intellectuals of Mexico, because they thought this was going to be a horse race. Had they not done that, and say this had gone up to about 20%, that would have been a tremendous show of force of the left, which they have not had for a while. So, at any rate, that's just some context about Mexico at the moment. And now, I mean, I say that in the sense of we've got a new reality down here, perhaps. Vicente Fox comes from a conservative party, represents big business interests. He was a Coca-Cola executive. But the most important thing is that it broke this up. And when you break up something it's like breaking up a glacier. you know, something's going on. And that's what happened. Pre was like a glacier, and somehow it went down. So we don't know what's going to come, but yes.
I had a question. Isn't this Pond Vicente Fox also associated with the Catholic Church?
Well, Pond, yeah, has been associated much with the conservative Catholic Church. That's correct.
Oh, the conservative one.
Yes.
Not the one that's been the only opposition.
No, no, no.
I just knew. Thank you.
Okay. But let me do a little bit of poetry, because I think to begin to look at borders, this border, and particularly the more I've thought about this, because this is new for me too, and this is what's very helpful is to think in terms of kind of ecosystems. The people too are part of an ecosystem. And as you know, when an ecosystem gets dramatically interrupted by a volcano or an earthquake or something, I mean, some major transformation happens. What this area of the southern United States, northern Mexico, has been an ecosystem which I say has been radically interrupted right now by a wall and by law enforcement and, you know, under the guise of controlling drug traffic and the like and anti-terrorism. Those things are real. So what has happened as a result of break up an ecosystem. Gene Sylvester, a good friend of mine in Minneapolis, took us on a nature hike once, and he took us to the edge of a forest and a meadow. He said, if you want to see movement, change, dynamism, this is where it's at, right on an edge of something, on the edge of two systems, on the edge of two things that are somewhat more homogenous, or they look somewhat homogenous, and that's why you go out here at night and you start seeing the deer, you start seeing the birds in the morning, all that beauty. It's at moments like that where there's activity, motion, both opportunity and risk. There's convergence, there's diversity. It's not like the monoculture of a cornfield. You know, there's something going on. There's a lot more going on. Continuity and change. And if we begin to think about borders along some of those terms, we often think in two spheres. Here's Mexico, let's say, and here's the United States, or here's one realm and here's another. And as you quite well know, there's a dynamism back and forth to this, and it changes and it moves. It's not static over here and over here. And you can see it's kind of the yin and the yang, you know, it's always out there and they interrelate. But it's at these margins where things really are taking place. Right in there, right? That's where things mix, like the ocean and the shore. Look at where things begin to change, the west side of a mountain, the east side of a mountain, north slope, south slope of a mountain, light and dark. A lot of intrigue there.
Good and evil.
Good and evil. Black and white. Brown skin. Light skin. Rich. Poor. Minority. Majority. The powerful. The powerless. Those are some of the fences, the edges, the margins, the borders that I think really also have a lot to do with how we look at this line. And even how we define that line. Sovereignty and interdependence relationship. Isolationism or globalization or mutuality. And you can think of things like yesterday, 1848. Today, the year 2000. Tomorrow. You know, the past, the present. What's the future? Those are borders, and there's a dynamic thing in there, languages. Te hablo en español, me hablas en español, no? Si no te entiendo, pues, ni modo. Huh? I mean, it's, if you, you know, there's something in that communication. male and female, gay, straight, young and old, the inner self, the outer self, all of that dynamism, the consciousness of yourself and your unconscious. Then there's the me and the you, the known and the unknown, the familiar and the unfamiliar. Even things like, and all of this, I would say, thinking about this, all of those dynamics play themselves out in a way when we think about borders. Even things like conception. How was I conceived? How was a nation conceived and given birth and matures and becomes related to others and dies? Issues like mortality. What is mortal? What is immortal? What is temporal? What is eternal? All of those kinds of things which are edges on this kind of this spectrum of, say, of absolutes over against, say, kind of a relativism or a situational when it pulls together. Now, I'm in this because I care about these issues because of the church and because of what I have understood biblically, theologically, because of Christ. And I want to just do a quick piece from some stuff I've been playing with, some from years of work in Latin America, but it doesn't have to come from there, and it's simple stuff. God. Just God. I mean, that's... And then what was... There was a void. Really, there was nothingness. And into that, God did not really feel complete with this void and this nothingness. And it's, if we say, like, God is love, God's self needs an object and a subject out there to love and to be loved. And so God creates. And all of a sudden we've got a tension, the creation itself and humanity itself. And we know that there's a brokenness there. And so we in the Christian faith profess that Jesus came to bring this brokenness back to right relationship. The mishpah, I think, is what Dan in his sessions has been talking about. Wholeness, integrity, oneness again. So it's bringing that back. So this is all about reconciliation and healing. And I think that a lot of that is playing out here. Gustavo Gutierrez, who's a well-known Peruvian theologian, talks about the other, el otro. Our relationship, my relationship to the other, el otro. And that's this kind of a relationship between me and you. And in much of Latin America, perhaps throughout the world, this is kind of the nothingness. We don't really know anything about this el otro, and we treat that person as like nothing, inconsequential. We could really do without that person, out of sight, out of mind. But Gustavo Gutierrez is saying that no, we have to encounter that other, which is encountering Jesus, encountering this reality of death, and in seeing this death toward resurrection. So right now what's happening is that these migrants are really the other in our society, in our midst today. And we use them and abuse them and spit them out, and it is just atrocious what happens to them. And people are dying as they come up through Central America on the trains with the coyotes as they cross here. About 37 deaths this year just in the Yuma sector alone of people who have died along the border, most because of exposure to the extreme heats in the winter, to the cold, but on occasion shot to death or falling or run over by a truck or a car. So that's the dynamic of this U.S. southern border. And I would say that we've got to enter into it in some ways with that framework of trying to understand what borders are. There are some maybe objective realities to border, but most of it is up here. So the first border we have to cross is really up here in our hearts and in our guts about the issues that we think are out there. Now, we don't have, an agenda per se as LIRS or me personally. What I am quite convinced of is that the resources, and this Dimitri in his paper would say also, and others, I was at a Carnegie Endowment Forum about a week ago in Washington, a Canadian gave his impression of U.S. immigration policies after 5 years in the United States working on those issues with the Canadian Embassy. And he said, is this cost effective? Now, where this plays out, say, on the Canadian border, some really interesting dynamics. I'll get into this more tomorrow. After 1996, part of the 1996 law immigration reform was that there was going to be an entry and exit control. It's called Section 110 of the immigration reform. The Canadians, which would have meant that along the Canadian border with Mexico, every person that enters has to register, and when you leave, you have to check out. And the Canadians balked. They said, this is impossible. And this is post-NAFTA now. In the last 10, 15 years, there have been 3 trade agreements with Canada. Their first was an auto parts agreement, which started really moving a lot of stuff across the border. Then there was a Canadian-U.S. trade agreement, and then there's the North America Free Trade Agreement. Trade has accelerated tremendously. $1 billion U.S. dollars cross the U.S.-Canadian border every day in goods. There is more commerce across the Windsor-Detroit Bridge, the Ambassador Bridge, in a year than all of Canada's trade with Japan on one bridge. So they're saying, this is stupid. If you do this, you're going to back us up to kingdom come, on the bridge. You can't do it. So they fought that. Why was Section 110 put in there? Do you think they were thinking about Canada?
No.
They were thinking about Mexico.
So what has NAFTA done for Mexico? What is the trade there? Did it increase?
Trade has increased tremendously. We're not going to get into a lot on NAFTA. I didn't prepare a lot on NAFTA. There's some materials on NAFTA. But in fact, it has increased tremendously. There's a lot more activity. And as of course you know, there's a lot more maquilas on the other side of the border. But it is a part of this dynamic of what's going on and how do we manage that border area. Now, my time is just about up. One of the most creative thoughts I have heard, it was an insight to me, maybe it's obvious to most, and particularly for people who live along the border, it's sort of like, hey, wake up, smell the coffee. It's rather than see a border like this as a line, see it as a strip, kind of a 25, 50 mile band in which things kind of wash. It's sort of like the ocean shore kind of thing, that dynamic or whatever that might be. You know, just let this slosh. Just let this, you know, if you're getting $8 an hour over here, get $8 an hour over here. You know, rather than $50 a week working in a maquila for a young woman from Central Mexico, $50 a week. Or something like that. Now, again, going back to the ecosystem, what's happened is this wall has come down so tight that it in fact has already, things like that were going on. There was pretty free movement up until like 1994, 95, 96, along this border. We're tightening it. And in fact, we do have in many places, not one wall, like in San Diego, Tijuana, you've got three walls. You've got a first perimeter, a steel wall. If you get over that, you get into kind of a no person's land. And then there's a barbed wire fence and Border Patrol going up and down with this concertina wire, razor wire. And if you get through that, there's another one. And along the day and night, there are patrols, and at night, the bright, bright lights, and three layers. And what that has done then is force people from this area, and so now they're coming into this Bisbee and Douglas, Arizona area. Soon they think they're going to be hitting Yuma and Del Rio because they're going to tighten up. Gone from 300 Border Patrol up to 1,400 Border Patrol just in the Tucson sector in this last year. So, you know, it's like, I don't know what it would be if you stop something up here, it's going to find its way out over here. It's just not stopping. So I've been in all along here. I was in a Catholic Religious Order house for migrants, in various cities along here, but just in Juarez, in Nuevo Laredo about a month ago, they're attending 600 people a month, and that's probably a small slice of the amount of migrants coming through. And I sat and talked to some of the migrants, and the stories are phenomenal. Why they had to leave, and the this tremendous struggle to get up through Mexico for this desire, basically, I need to sustain my family. I just don't have anything. And they send right now to Mexico what they call remittances, money earned in the United States by Mexicans, $6 billion a year. It's the third largest source of foreign currency after tourism and petroleum.
No, those are the Mexicans at home that they earn a portion of that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to just... There's a lot of materials up here. I think this is one of the issues that we as a church and other churches hopefully will get our heads around. Dimitri's paper has some interesting thoughts. Again, we as the church who should transcend borders, I think, have a role to play. In a way, I'd say we're playing catch-up. At least, although down in the trenches, people are saying, help, in the churches. They're saying, help. You know, isn't anybody listening out there? You know, don't you feel this? Don't you... they've also produced a video, imagine a day in a life without a Mexican in the United States. You know, who's going to do your lawn? Who's going to do all this stuff? Or the Salvadorans. It's right now, the FL-CIO, for example, has called for the documentation, legalization of all the undocumented in the U.S. Anyone have an estimate how many that might be? Rough figure, because nobody, obviously, how do you count the undocumented?
10 million?
About 5 to 6 million is the estimate, huh? So they're saying, let's document them. You know, we need their labor. Let's employ them. And then that, they also say, would slow down some of this flow. makes sense to me. But the church has not said that. You know, and maybe we're not going to get there in one block, you know, all 6 million all at once, but maybe there are some steps we can take along the way. Okay.
You know what, you know, we live right there in Phoenix, and we're right in the middle of that, you call it migration. To me, that would be the term to use, but other people use the term immigration, mm-hmm. as if these people are coming from somewhere, from a foreign, distant land, when for what we feel as Mexicans of the Southwest, that what makes us different from all other immigrants, Spanish-speaking immigrants, is we have a land base. We were there when that was Mexico. Yet we've been made to feel like we're foreigners and deportable from our own homelands. And what we're confronted with today in Arizona, and probably all over the border, is the hostility against these people who, you know, have made huge sacrifices to leave their families, their homeland, to come to work and to send, in some cases, every cent to their families. You know, I mean, people are, they're calling it an invasion. Right. We're being invaded upon. Right. You know,
well, the other thing I wanted to say is when the U.S. decided to militarize the zone.
Here's some stuff on the ranchers who have become vigilantes.
The ranchers have become vigilantes, so we need to demilitarize the border. That's the only way. Oh, this is from New York Times. This is the only way that we're going to achieve and have dialogue.
Yeah, the Border Patrol has become the largest law enforcement agency of the United States. Incredible. You know, incredible. And is that a good place to apply resources?
You know, the other part of this equation, that it sure seems to me that we could do more, and certainly U.S. foreign policy could do more, is what can we do to help create jobs in Mexico, to give people meaningful work there?
Right.
I mean, we have capital. We have, now with NAFTA, it's much easier to build factories.
Well, but you see, what he's talking about, the maquilas that are down to the factories, U.S. and Japanese factories over there, these workers, they work all day long. They make $50 a week.
Yeah.
Where as soon as their husbands cross the border, they make $50 a day.
Yeah.
The whole thing of inequality, like you're talking about, rich and poor, is just too intense.
One of the things I want to study about, and maybe some of you know more about this, the European Union. How did that come about? At the time when they began talking about the European Union, which was about 30 years ago, the income disparity between the more wealthy countries of the eventual European Union was about 1/10. They made a very conscious effort to begin to invest in the poorer of the European nations, like Spain and Portugal and Italy. And they, right now, the income disparity is about 1/3. And now, as you know, I mean, you can go across the borders. I don't know all about the job market kinds of things, but now you can go and get employment throughout Europe if you're part of one of the EU member states, according to one of the treaties.
The income levels in Spain and in Ireland, which were two of the poorest countries in Europe, have really gone up.
Right. Exactly. They have. And we were recently in Portugal, and, you know, it's not like all the Portuguese are heading to Germany. You know, it's okay to remain in Portugal. A friend of mine says, you know, it's interesting. In the United States, where we have essentially a free movement of, you know, these borders don't hold you in, per se. Mississippi, which has the lowest per capita income, you know, not everybody's heading to Connecticut, where it's the highest per capita income, nor vice versa. You know, somehow people stabilize and they kind of, you know, I'm born here, I'll stay here, this is my people, my land, you know. Right now, the income disparity with Mexico, and this doesn't even sound right to me, but the figure that was cited to me last week by the Canadians and the Mexicans was 1/6. I can't imagine that. But factored into that, which is, again, what I cannot figure out, the World Bank just recently, and I've seen this in two quotations, the World Bank is saying that in Mexico, about 48%, getting up to 50% of the population of Mexico lives on $1 per day. That's about 50 million Mexicans. Now, how that gets factored up here, I don't know. What is very clear, and Mexico has always used immigration or this migration as an escape valve for its own social problems, and that's why PRI went down, because the people are saying, basta, we enough of not dealing with this poverty and unemployment and underemployment, that maybe there's a, because of the corruption, which has been, you know, rabid. See, what would make sense about this is that Mexico is not a poor country. Mexico is a very, very, very wealthy country. But that money is in the hands of a very, very, very few. And so, in some ways, that, I mean, it's astoundingly wealthy in the hands of a few. So now, maybe there's a possibility for the government of Mexico, and Vicente Fox, he's kind of a modernist capitalist, and I think his outlook has been less radically nationalistic than the pre-party, and probably less nationalistic than, quote, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas of the left. He said, we can work together, you know, economically. And he's got a MBA and all that from Harvard, and, you know, so maybe some things will start happening. Mexico, but what to do? And Mexico's got its own internal problems that are enormous with the indigenous people, the poor. I mean, you talk about El Otro, it's not just U.S. versus the Mexicans. Within Mexico, you were down in Chiapas, you know how the indigenous are despised. You know, you do not see a lot of Congress people in the assembly that are dark-skinned. You know, there's a, you know.
All the military's dark-skinned. All the Indios are dark-skinned because they have no choice.
Those reclutados, the conscripted.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
Okay.
They just move from one area to another.
So we just have a couple more minutes. Any other some observations or thoughts?
And we talked about all this. You didn't even talk about the drug war and how that's exacerbating the
sure.
situation.
The other interesting thing that's taking place because of this conversation around Section 110, we assign all sorts of tasks to a few points along the border. I don't know how many entry points there are, actual entry points, you know, say, everybody enter through this little port, same on Canada. Everybody enter through this port, and we will control your drugs, and we will take your taxes, your tariffs, and we will count you. And what they're saying is, why do we load up at the border all of these functions when actually today drug control takes place everywhere? You know, that's something, you know, you do it internally. You know, why load that up here? Now, the Border Patrol has become the single largest interdictor of drugs, which is interesting. You would think that that's the job of Customs. They're not, they're not picking it up. But they're, you know, we're picking up drugs all over the place and intelligence. And so now there's a lot of dynamics going on. In fact, they're, in a way, we're pushing the borders. For example, the Chinese have been coming into Seattle and Vancouver and all that, and San Francisco, and where's the border on the Chinese issue right now? It's right off the coast of Fujian province in China. That's where we're trying to control the trafficking of Chinese. You know, not wait till they show up in a cargo box in San Francisco. You know, that's where our border is, and there's an agreement with Canada to do that. And no agreement with Canada to interdict those ships way back over there. I mean, that's high-tech Interpol satellite stuff.
Obviously, this gets very complex. I live in Texas and have observed all that we're talking about. If there was no migration in the state of Texas, our systems, say health system, educational system, are struggling to provide services, adequate services for the people that are there.
Right.
Then you add migration, it complicates it. For example, many of the school districts along the border on the Texas side are some of the poorest school districts in the state. They're the fastest growing because of the migration. Financially, that complicates their ability to build buildings, hire teachers, educate the children.
Yeah, absolutely.
We welcome them openly and we educate them. We seek to provide health services, but it just gets real complex.
Oh,
we struggle.
You're right on.
We struggle even when there's no migration.
Yes.
But isn't that an interesting thing then about what our internal borders do? Because then we're saying that those little towns on the southern border with Mexico are responsible. Instead of, if we had, and I'm not sure this is where we want to go, I've never given it any thought, but if we decided in the U.S. that education is so important that it needs to be nationally funded, then that issue would be very different. Not to say that various kinds of migration and immigration don't impact people in other places.
Yeah.
Certainly there are several cities in Minnesota who are experiencing a lot of new population.
Right.
It impacts our school systems and all our health care.
Yeah.
New York City has had that for generations.
Right.
Right? But we have these internal borders as well.
Right.
It says, well, that's a problem for Texas,
right,
or that's a problem for Mexico.
That's why this Arizona.
That's a problem for California, not a problem for North Dakota. Well, why not?
Right. Arizona senators and congresspeople are yelling, you know, we need help. You know, the feds have to pick up some of the costs in the hospitals and the schools. One of the interesting things, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, Mexico had probably one of the most enlightened healthcare systems and education systems. And part of what has happened over the years with things like IMF loans and all these structural adjustment, conditionality and all of that, they have torn apart what was the social service network or safety net for people. So that's part of what is driving migration. That's part of what is really driving, because you don't have what you used to have before. And so we are now. And where's that decision driven? Not in Mexico City. It's driven by the World Bank and monetarist policies in the hands of a very few that decide, okay, you've got to tighten up your economy, modernize it, neoliberal economics through the whole Reagan-Bush era. And what you have to do is cut back social funding. And so they did. And they slashed and they slashed and they slashed. And part of what we're getting particularly out of Mexico is a result of that. Same with the land liberalization issue, where they began to break up the ejido lands. And also it relates to NAFTA. There's a direct impact of NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
For example, corn, you know, which the people of corn, the Maya people, you know, we came from corn. That's the mythology, you know, that's the creation. These are the people of corn that now, there's no sense planting corn when you can buy corn from Nebraska cheaper than I can produce it with the sweat of my brow. You know, so we've now dumped corn on the Mexican corn market. You know, so again, who's moving to the cities? The campesinos off the land, you know, it's breaking that ecosystem. And so they go in, and of course there's no jobs there, or they put pressure on the jobs there, and people migrate to the north. And you know, it's in some ways you kind of say, Well, it's really a revolution like the Industrial Revolution, which all of that stuff which changes the migration picture. And I don't think we've understood yet what NAFTA has done. We're beginning to see it. And just within the framework of NAFTA, and boy, there's a lot to be said about that, but as you know, this was all about trade across the borders. And it was about kind of investment issues and how do you get capital and things across the border and like the maquila industry and all of that. Then the environmentalists said, well, wait a minute, you know, there are environmental considerations here. And so the environmentalists got, with a lot of work, they finally got, because Al Gore stepped in, you know, Mr. Green, and they got an environmental side agreement. But what was sidestepped entirely, but very intentionally, was a labor agreement. You know, what's going to happen with labor in this mix? Goods, services, capital, cross over the border, companies, but the human being. And they left that out. So now what some people are beginning to talk about, Dimitri being one, and I've started to work on it with some colleagues in Mexico, and we now have a great partnership here with quite a lot of organizations. But what about a worker visa? Some kind of a long-term worker visa where you can move, a North America visa. The Canadians have an ag guest worker program that works pretty nicely. We no longer have the Bracero program. There is somewhat of a guest worker program, and say if it weren't for the quickest way to shut down the tobacco industry would be to kick out all the Mexicans out of Kentucky and North Carolina. I mean, you would have no tobacco, you know? So what's on the table at some is a new guest worker program, agriculture guest worker program, very contentious. It hasn't moved any place, but we may have to get something. They're out here. They're in the Willamette Valley. They're around Wenatchee, you know, and they're doing the work, huh? And they're in our restaurants, the what they call essential workers, hotels, restaurants, tourism industry, all of those essential workers. If they were all out of here, well, we'd go down. Yes, John.
I think one of the challenges is I mean, hey, we're sitting in Bloomington, Illinois,
yeah.
And there's a, we're not, you know, it isn't an issue in a sense for us.
Right.
It is, but it, you know.
Sure.
The question of it's, I really appreciate the perspective that you're beginning to. It's not like a simple, you know, either or kind of deal.
Right.
So there's a real mix here, and the poetry of it is kind of a neat idea. But the question is to what extent does the church press a solution, or does it press or object to what's happening right now? Or do we say here is a solution, and it doesn't seem like we have a solution even that we can even. In other words, this is the problem: when we object to what's going on, we can object and yell at people, saying
right.
This is not right, this is not right. But where is it proactively where we
yep.
can assert something that has some integrity, that has some purpose, that people can say this is something worth fighting for? See, that's the question.
Yeah.
How to get that?
Yeah. Well, I like. I mean, I think that we're in that. We're trying to find that one. I mean, just understanding, and we're weak, but we need help too. And and there are things to object to. But I'm saying now, let's start thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
I think that's one place to start.
Yeah.
And say the 6 million undocumented.
Yeah.
Some of those are the ones that are going back and forth because. So if you're working up here in Wenatchee picking, what is it, apples or something, and you may have been here 15 years, huh? And your mother dies in Mexico, you're going to go back to the funeral. How are you going to get back? You've got to cross without inspection.
Oh, and all your
and
kids,
so you get caught.
And you've raised a family here.
Yeah.
And some of your
yeah.
kids have graduated from college and are ideal citizens, and you can't get back into this country.
One component of this new proposal of the guest worker program would say, if you have worked in the United States for the last year, you may be eligible. I mean, there's all these caveats. You may be eligible to apply for temporary residency in the United States, and within that, you must go back to Mexico 2 months out of the year. Well, somebody may have been working here for 20 years and has never gone back, you know, and is never documented. They've never been documented. Unless you have a U.S.-born child, then you have the right to remain here. And you are obligated to work for 180 days out of a year. And after 5 years or 5 years out of 7 years, if you've worked there, you might be considered for legal permanent residence. You might be. So for out to 7 years, you could be essentially an indentured servant, selling your labor. And so we're working at that. The United Farm Workers and others are against it because of the conditions. If they'll drive down wages, the housing conditions aren't adequate. But there might be something in that mix, Joel.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the church has not worked hard enough. U.S. Catholic Conference has studied that a lot because they work with Mexican farm workers a lot more than we do. They have opposed that guest worker bill because of what it doesn't give to the farm worker. But I talked to, there's a Lutheran pastor in the Willamette Valley. He said, give us something, you know, even something, you know, crumbs off the table. Give us something, you know, that we can, you know. But other workers are saying, you know, we're not going to work for $4 an hour, you know.
On a broader, out-of-the-box way of looking at it, maybe one thing is for the church to address this whole thing of American corporations that leave ethics out altogether, mm-hmm. where everything they do is, you know, bottom line at all costs. And if the church could maybe influence corporations to make decisions that are ethical and moral.
Oh, and the history has just been deplorable all over. I mean, corporations, excuse me, I mean, you know, we depend on them, but I was just in Mexico at a meeting and from the old Bracero program and the people that built the railroads way up as far as Chicago and worked some of these, they worked, there's Clayton Anderson, I don't know if anyone has any connections or knows anything about them. They employed a lot of people and probably others. And, you know, the Braceros were forced out. Those that were working down here were actually forced out by bayonet. The National Guard would sweep through the fields and push them out. Everybody in 1954, I think, had to leave. Well, they left, and they didn't get, under the terms of their employment, they were putting money into Social Security. They weren't paid their Social Security. The agreement from the Bracero program is the United States guaranteed that they would get this through the... So money was put in a bank in Chicago, and they've been holding that pension money. These people are not getting their money. And it's 50 years almost, 45 years after they, and now these people are old, you know, and they're poor, they are dirt poor, and they're saying, we worked up there for all these years, and, you know, and I'm saying, where's the church?
Well, you know, that's happening on a one-on-one basis.
Well, that's something to address, right? And it's those specific things.
Yeah, yes. Right, and we have, in the past, we worked for the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility and things like that, where we can put a shareholder resolution on the table at a, you know, their shareholder annual meeting or something like that. But you need to have actions in there yourself. And so it takes some research and all that. Thanks very much. Yeah.